Okay, thank you very much, Lee. That was very beautiful. A few musical phrases in there. It sounded like Danny Boy, but it wasn't quite, was it? But close. Close enough. Very beautiful words in any case. Appreciate you coming up here and doing that for us. We've gone through a period where we have seen people whom we have associated with and fellowship with on a spiritual plane change from what they professed and declared that at the time they would never change or give up their beliefs. And yet it happened on a scale unimaginable. How do you account for that? I've been asked that question many times, and this is not the only time that I've personally seen it. I've seen it on many other occasions also, where people were so sure as to where they stood, what they believed, that they would never depart from what they believed, and yet it happened. It's a little bit scary. I want to reduce it down to one idea that I believe we can all understand, and after we are through, perhaps we can learn something that is so vital to our own eternal lives. One thing Christ wants to know about all of us, the question he keeps asking is, are you genuine? Are we an authentic follower of Christ? Hence the title of the message today, The Authentic Christian. In fact, this is the first of a series. And that's why I want to come back next week. I want to continue the series, and I suspect there's going to be about four or five, maybe six parts to what I want to bring you today. Today is more of an introduction to it because there are a number of aspects to this, and I feel it's a very important subject. You might ask, how could a person be anything else but authentic and genuine? Why would we assume someone is not authentic? First of all, I don't think that we should treat people as if we suspect they are inauthentic, because authenticity is something more than outward. We may observe a person. We may observe a person's outward behavior sometimes, and we may conclude, oh, you know, that person's got problems. But you don't know what goes on inside that person's mind, do you? And we would be making a judgment based on outward appearances. And God says, don't do that. You could be mistaken. At the same time, we could be making a judgment based only on outward appearances and take a look at that and not know what's on the inside. God wants to know what is on the inside. That's the only way that he will know whether the person is genuine or authentic. We know that if a solid gold coin is authentic, it is solid gold all the way through. It is pure. It's not just gold-plated or colored gold, nor is it mixed with any other metal. I suppose there is some metal in all, but you have, if it is gold, if it says it's 18 carat or 24 carat, well, then that is exactly what it should be, because it says it. I saw a little clip about, I forgot, one of the magazine programs that they have, that four out of five jewelers that they went to and they bought things from them went and had the gold piece assayed, and they found out it was not what they said it was. Now, not everybody's going to do that, because you're not going to go buy some gold piece, pay a high price for it, and go get it assayed by... Because to do that, they have to pull the thing apart, cut out a bit of it. It ruins it for all practical purposes. They have to melt it down, then they have to test to see, okay, what are the metals are in it. Well, they actually did that. They found four out of five jewelers were selling gold, whether they knew it or whether they didn't know it, that was not what or the amount of gold they said it was. And some had very little gold in it at all, but they were selling it for quite a pure product. In 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little time, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory in the revelation of Jesus Christ. Could faith be less than genuine? Is that possible? How would you know? would you say my faith is what it should be? It's that way because I think it is. Is that the test? And first of all, how would God know? First of all, the genuineness of our faith is tested. That's what he says. And that's the only way that God can know if it is genuine. And it can't be done in any other way. There are no shortcuts to this. It doesn't matter what you have on your application. It doesn't matter what you say that you are or the way that you are. It is what you actually do on a consistent basis that is also consistent with what you claim. And now when we come to what we say we are and what we actually are in fact two different things. Now some people seem to pride themselves over the fact that, well, what you see is what you get. That's just the way it is. There is no difference. I would beg to differ on that. For the simple reason is the fact that you even make such a comment tells me that there's a certain amount of pride there. And the fact that you have that tells me that there's something, you're not exactly the way you're making yourself out to be, because if a person is true, he doesn't make himself out to be anything, does he? Why should he? Because he is the real thing. In any case, the genuineness or the trueness of any one person has to be tested. That is the only way God will know. And it cannot be done any other way. You cannot assume it simply because what a person does. What if that a person's track record is okay while times are good? That's fine. But it says here, he talks about you're grieved by various trials. That's the way you find out if it is the genuine thing. Is it real? Is it real all the way through? I think I've told you the story of the Navy SEALs, the man who devised that whole program and headed up the training of the Navy SEALs. And it, of course, it's quite a stringent training. It is the, let's say, the one of the highest cadres an enlisted man can get into, if he qualifies first to get into it. And so they do. They try to qualify to go into training to become a Navy SEAL. But even though they may take the ones they think are the best candidates, you do not know who's going to make it through to the end until the end. They may have a certain suspicion that certain ones will do real well. And in every case, almost, there are surprises. Because the ones that you think are going to make it don't quite make it. And the ones that you think are not going to make it, they're the ones who wind up making it. Because you don't know what's on the inside of a person. And it's not how a person is built. It's not how strong a person is. It's not how good-looking a person is. And God made that kind of a statement whenever they were choosing David as king. Because outwardly, they would have chosen David's brothers. But God saw what was on the inside of a person, and God saw that there was a lot more to that person. And even then, David had to be tested to see for a minimum of about 13 years, so far as we can, as best we can determine. And that then made him the king that he was, so much so that he has a very important and prominent place in the future of God's plan. And so God knew what he was doing. Way back then, he had to know. And there is only one way to know. It cannot be done any other way. There are no shortcuts to it. The church has been sifted. It has been tried. The sifting was done on the basis of doctrine or the basis of teaching for the most part. I would say that maybe, I don't want to get into this aspect of it, but I would think that there's a little bit more to it than that, and that's still going on. But on the surface then, or let's say at the outset, I think is a better way of putting it, that the church has been sifted on the basis of doctrine and the basis of teaching. Is that the only basis of our sifting? If it was, we might say that we have passed. Wouldn't it be nice to think that? Whenever you think that you've passed an exam, perhaps, that tells you how you did, we tend to rest on our laurels. I got a question here. Is God still sifting? And if so, on what basis? So this is the first of a series on the authentic Christian. Do we know that we are authentic? Do we think we are right now, at this moment, authentic? Because there are a lot of aspects to our lives we ought to take a look at our worship, for instance, what goes on in our own hearts and minds, in our relationships, our marriage, and there are several other ways that we're going to have a look at this. All with a theme or the idea is, are we the real thing? So the question is, are we then, and will we in the future still be tested? One of the foremost themes that occurred over and over again when Jesus dealt with his own disciples and with other people was the genuineness he was looking for in a person. Was the person real in what he claimed or what he made himself out to be? Because Jesus would not let a statement go without bringing the person to a better understanding of himself and also a better understanding of what Jesus himself was all about. Jesus wanted to know. He told the rich young ruler, for instance, when he came to him and said, "What must I do to have salvation?" So he told him, but Jesus never left it at that. He says, if you want to be a follower of me, you go sell what you have, give to the poor, and then come and follow me. Now he really wanted to get to the heart and core of the matter, is how much do you really mean what you said? It's easy enough to keep and obey God's commandments when things are going well. But how far are you willing to go? That's what Jesus wanted to know. And so he got straight into the matter to find out, okay, I want to know what is in your heart. What's important to you? In John 6, verse 66 and 67, at the incident where Jesus is talking to a lot of disciples, not just the 12, but a lot of them, about you have to eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, otherwise you have no life in you. And they were offended at that. And it says, from that time, many of his disciples went back and walked with him no more. They were offended at what he had to say. So then Jesus turned to the 12. Will you also go away? Just let's cut to the chase, guys. Let's get right down to it. What do you want to do? Does this affect you? I want to know where you stand. I want to know what is in your heart. On another occasion, he turned to the multitudes. And you've heard me quote this to you on a number of occasions because I think it's such an important principle. Jesus turned to the multitudes in Luke 14, verse 26, and said, if you're going to follow me, you have to love me more than your brothers and sisters, your father and your mother, your wife and your children, and even your own life also, more than anything you have. He says, I don't want you to follow me under any misapprehensions. I want you to really know what you're doing. Have you really counted the cost? Are you prepared to follow me? He wanted to get down to the heart and the core of the matter with these vast multitudes who were following him for whatever reasons, because he was feeding them, he was performing miracles, he was a person who had the promise of a kingdom of which they really wanted, which they didn't fully understand, and he wanted to get right down to, why are you following me? That was the question. I want to know what's in your heart. I'm not interested in what you, outwardly, what you're doing. Are you going to stick with it? Do you really mean what you seem to say? He told his disciples then, at the end of his discourse, just before he was arrested, and he talked about belief in him. And he went over and over the same idea, time and time. And the disciples finally said, now we believe. And you know what he said? Do you? You think you do? Do you? And of course, the hearts of many would be revealed that night. Even Peter, who said, I won't forsake you. I won't deny you. And Jesus looked at him and says, yes, you are. You got sifted. He got sifted to show what was in his heart. You can see right there, this is not a matter of doctrine. We're not talking about doctrine. We're talking about, are you prepared to stand up for what you say you are? Peter was very vehement, very adamant as to what he said he was, what he believed, and of it, and his own capability or capacity to carry it out. And Jesus knew better. And so he had to bring Peter to the point where Peter had to see himself for what he really was. And he did. It's quite an amazing story how God could do this very quickly. And then he told Peter, after he was resurrected, do you love me, Peter? Now, that's pretty interesting, isn't it? Some wives ask their husbands that, don't they? Do you love me? Why? We want to cut to the chase, don't we? Is that how you feel? Is that how you really feel? We're going to talk about that when we talk about marriage. Do you? If so, what do you mean by that? Are we going through the motions? Are we just in it because it's convenient? Are we not going to forsake or run because the alternative isn't too good, so I may as well stick around? I don't know. What's our motives? Are we authentic in everything that we do? You see, this is the question, and this is what Jesus wanted to know. Time and time again, when he talked to people, I can go through the Gospels, he got right down to the issue immediately. Is it possible, then, for a person to perfectly know the teachings of God, the true teachings of God, I'm not talking about the false teachings, to perfectly know that, to be able to perfectly explain it, not only explain it, but to preach it in such an effective and even a powerful way to where people are converted as a result of that preaching and still not be true all the way through in the person in his own life. Christ saw it was possible to possess the truth of God, to articulate it well, but the fruits weren't there. Because, as we read in other places, it doesn't matter if a person has knowledge. I hear about people who, you know, are very impressed with a person's knowledge. And as Mr. Armstrong said, knowledge is of no value unless you are using it. Means if you live by it. So the knowledge you have may be pretty heavy on the scale. How we live by it may not be so heavy on the scale. So there'll be a little bit of imbalance here. So we know a lot more than what we do sometimes. The authentic person is one who is also what he says. He is careful to make claims because he knows deep down in his own heart, maybe that's not the way I really am. But you see, that's a fact a lot of us don't like to face up to. But we do have to face up to it because Christ will know. And if he asked the question and he posed the question to people, to his own disciples back then, and to other ordinary people who came to him for whatever reason and entered into a discussion with them, and he posed those same kinds of questions, do you think he's asking the same kinds of questions now of us? I would suggest yes. Matthew chapter 7, verse 13. Matthew 7, verse 13. Enter in by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it. Because narrow is the gate, and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it. He seems to say that only the real ones, the genuine ones, the authentic ones will make it through the narrow gate. That is why it is difficult. Perhaps that's why it has to be difficult, so he can see who the real ones are. If it was easy, you wouldn't know. And then he goes on to say in verse 15 that this is how you will know someone. And he's giving a very interesting point, making a very interesting point here. He said, now beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. So it's what's on the inside of a person that we're talking about here. You will know them by their fruits. Now that's very interesting. He doesn't say you'll know them by how they preach. He doesn't say you'll know them by how much knowledge they have. But he says you'll know them by their fruits. That is, well, what is produced? What is happening here in the person's life, in the person's ministry, in the person's family? You see, you can see this. It's there. So there are fruits. Somewhere along the line, there are fruits. How are those fruits can be defined? We talk about the fruits of the Spirit. Are those fruits of the Spirit then being produced? I would suggest those are a very, very important way of understanding fruits. Do men gather grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Even so, every good tree bears good fruit, but every bad tree bears bad fruit. Real simple principle here. This is not hard to understand. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a bad tree bear good fruit. In other words, what's he saying? If something is good, it's good all the way through. That's the way it has to be. It's either a good tree or a bad tree, and it may look good. And we even have the parables two statements and parables about a fig tree, remember, where you had a fig tree there and it looked good. And Jesus came to look for fruit, and he said, there wasn't any fruit. Now, that tree should have been bearing some kind of fruit because it was there long enough. We have another little story about a fig tree, another parable that he gave about a fig tree that's been there for 3 years, wasn't bearing fruit, and the keeper of the garden said, well, let me just fertilize this here a little bit more. Let me just dig around it. Let me just work with it. And if it bears fruit, fine. If it doesn't, okay, then cut it down. Let's just don't cut it down right away. Okay, but it has to bear fruit. Christ expected to bear fruit. So how it looks is one thing. And so on the occasion where he cursed the fig tree, he saw it afar off, because you see a fig tree, and it was before the time of figs, admittedly. However, in all cases, there is likely some fruit on it, whether it's green or small fruit, that should have been there, and therefore would have had the potential, and he came, and it says he found nothing. And then he cursed the fig tree. Now, he wanted to do that, of course, as a lesson. So it's not known how it looks. Green, with foliage, healthy. From a distance, it looked wonderful. No fruit. It had a problem. Christ had a problem with it. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Therefore, by their fruits you shall know them. That's the test. Sometimes you go years before you know a tree is bad. A tree can look good. But that is not the criterion, and you may not know for several years, as we've already indicated. Now he goes on to say something else. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. So a person can talk a good talk. They can say a lot of great things. They can put some tremendous things on their application. But now, are they able to really come through with the goods? It's not what they say about the Lord or how fervent they seem to be in calling upon the Lord. Do they do the will of my Father in heaven? Consistently. All the time. Not just in front of people, but when they get home by themselves and when nobody's watching. That's what he's talking about here. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, done many wonders in your name? Is that the criterion? Absolutely not. A person can do many wondrous things. And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. Because he knows only the true people. And the criterion is, who do I dwell in? If so, how much do I dwell in them? To what extent am I invited inside that person? Jesus knows. I don't know. You don't know. Jesus knows, as we find in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 19, the Lord knows those who are his. How does he know? He should know. He knows who he dwells in and who he doesn't dwell in. And he's only going to dwell in a person if he's invited to. And I think you and I can understand that a little bit if we understand how whenever we engage a person in a conversation, and if the conversation is superficial, that gives you an idea that you're not being invited very far into that person's life. You say, okay, that's as far as you go, because that's as far as that person's going to let you into their life. Now, if you get to know a person and the person's prepared to invite you a little bit more in, well, you might get to know that person a little bit more. Jesus, but you can determine this, don't you? We all do this. We all know how far to go when we're engaging each other in conversations. Like I told you before, when somebody said, well, how are you? You can say, oh, fine. Well, I decided not to do that, and since my wife's been gone almost a month, people ask me, how are you? I said, I'm miserable. So I've invited that person into that aspect of my life. You want to take it further? I'm happy to talk to you about it. Okay, so that's it's a part of being open, isn't it? And so that I think that's a very good point. These are some of the points, incidentally, that we will cover in future sermons, incidentally. Now, Christ knows in verse 24 how you are the real thing. Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And what does it mean, he does them? I mean, he starts out doing them, he keeps on doing them, and it doesn't matter what else happens, he's still going to do them. Now, that's a person who's consistent with what he says. And the rains descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded upon the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rains descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on the house, and it fell, and great was its fall. Well, what's the point here? The storms are going to come. They're going to happen. And whether we stand or not is going to depend, is going to tell the story, what have we been doing? What have we been doing all along? I am suggesting right here, if you would like an answer, what determines whether a person is going to stay with it or not is, have they been doing it? This is a very simple idea, but this is what Christ said. Have they been doing it? Not just talking about it, not able to give a good answer, have a good discussion, have a good word, or whatever. Have they been doing it? He knows. So he sends storms. Storms will always come. They will always come. Nobody's exempt from it. And this then tells the story. Jesus dealt with hypocrites, those who professed but didn't do. Matthew 23. Verse 1. When Jesus spoke to the multitudes, and to his disciples. He wanted them to understand something. At the end of a particularly difficult questioning period by the Pharisees. And so he turned to them and I said, I want you to understand something, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to do, observe. That observe and do. But do not do according to their works, for they say and do not. That's very interesting, the way he put that there. He didn't say that you weren't supposed to do them. He didn't say that they were wrong, even though he did prove them wrong on some occasions about their interpretation of prophecy, especially about him, and their understanding of how God's law ought to be kept and observed. He disagreed with them on that, too. However, they were still a certain, let's say, a reasonably reliable authority when you compare them with all of the other cultures around them. I think that's the way he would view it. But it's very interesting that you do what they say, but don't follow what they do. Isn't that interesting? You know what Jesus said? He said, follow me. Not only do you do what I say, but also follow me. He said about these people, do what they say, but don't follow them. Why? We got a problem here. There's a big discrepancy in what they said they were and what they made themselves out to be, as we go on to read. For they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. But all their works they do to be seen by men. They make their phylacteries broad and enlarge the borders of their garments. And why were they doing this? Jesus addressed this on a number of occasions, that what they did for the purpose of exercising an authority and a control over the other people. It was a shell. It was a sham. It was outward. There wasn't anything on the inside. That's why he said, don't do what they do. Now, the true leadership of Jesus Christ says this: not only do what I command you, but also follow me, because there is no discrepancy. Paul allowed for a discrepancy. When Paul said, follow me as I follow Christ, didn't he? Okay. So, with a genuine article, the genuine thing, you can say, I follow it as he follows Christ. So you better know who the genuine article is. It's very important. And he could say that then to the Corinthians, which I'll talk to you about in just a moment, as to some of the difficulties they had. But what they did to be seen. And behind all of that show and veneer, there was something pretty ugly. And if there's something ugly on the inside, I suppose that something is to be expected anyway, because we're human. But the real crime in all of this was to make out like they were the only real, honest people around because of their professed religion. And then put that out in front of people. That was the crime. And this is what Jesus took exception to. And this is what Jesus exposed. Indeed, he exposes this in every person. And I can show you case after case where Jesus moved people. The people that he encountered. He moved them from a shallow profession to come to the real core of who they were. I've already given you a few examples of that. But when even if they came to him about healing, or there was some other issue, he engaged them in a conversation. He said, let's talk about your faith for a moment. Why are you asking me this? Let's find out what you're going to do. Let's see how much you really mean what you said. Do you really believe? He's asking people this. He's asking them to come to this. And the Pharisees and would question him. They would come, Master, we have a question. They were trying to get him. They were going to question him. They were demanding a question from him. And in the end, he exposed them. He started asking them some questions that they couldn't answer. And it showed that they tried to expose him, and he wound up exposing them. When he was before Pilate, Pilate demanded, with all of his authority that he thought he had, are you king of the Jews? And in the end of the questioning, Pilate came away questioning himself. Maybe for the first time in his life, he began to question himself. And he didn't know. This is what an encounter with Jesus does. It helps you to come to the point where you begin to take a look at yourself in a way that you've never done before. And there's nothing wrong with that. The dictionary defines something as authentic as when it conforms to what it is represented or claimed to be. Authenticity means consistency between words and actions, between claimed values and actual priorities. Inauthenticity means we claim to be one thing and then prove to be something else. This is what is so abhorrent in Jesus' sight. This is what he wants to know. You see, he has to know, because he's got to count on it. He's got to count on it during the tough times. Let's take a look at our situation in the church. We've all been in the church for years. We've all been in the church for years. And we're still sinning. You might say, well, how do you know that? Well, I just know. I think if you're honest, that's something you'll confess yourself. What I'm coming to is this. Could we be relying on the outward observances of the law? Some of us do, and we make some pretty decent changes to begin with. We're concerned with the observances of the Sabbath, whether we observe it or not. You know, we're still asking questions about how to observe the Sabbath after 30, 40 years sometimes. And one question that keeps coming up is it okay to eat in a restaurant on the Sabbath? This is a very interesting question because I think it's a little bit revealing. It's not that, I'm not saying you're not genuine in wanting to know. That's not the point I'm making here. It seems to be we're more content on trying to be right and judging others and coming to a conclusion based on our own ideas. We discussed this 50 years ago. This came up in ministerial conferences led by Mr. Armstrong, and just as a little bit of a lesson, Mr. Armstrong always gave answers based on the intent of the law. What was the spiritual intent of the law? What was in God's mind when He created the Sabbath? Would you know? And to say, to simply take the laws as it was stated to apply to a people when the law was given. You have the law being given in a certain way, directed toward a certain particular culture. I don't think any of you have donkeys that you say you're not going to allow to work. That's not what we're into anymore, are we? But the law was specifically stated that way. So if we're going to really follow it down to the letter. The point is, what's the intent of the law? What was it there for? And Jesus had to do that with the Pharisees when they confronted him as to what he did on the Sabbath. He says, let me explain something to you. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. You've got it turned around, and you need to understand what the Sabbath was made for. So therefore, take a look at me and what I'm doing. Follow me, he said. He wasn't afraid of that. What is the intent of the law? A changed heart and a changed mind. That's where it's going. That's where it always goes. That's where it should have gone back in the Old Testament. That's where it goes now. That's the direction of it. Let me say something here. We hide behind the Sabbath. We tend to hide behind the holy days. We tend to hide behind our diet. We hide behind some of the other outward observances of God's law. We hide behind all the knowledge we have. We hide behind some of the claims we make. Some people hide behind the fact that they are confident that they're the true church. Let me put it this way. If you make those kind of claims, you're the true church. I'm going to follow this person. If I'm in this group, that means, well, that means I'm where I'm supposed to be. What happens? You take certain liberties in other areas. This is sort of a catch-all. I say we hide behind it sometimes, and we let a lot of other things go in our lives. We give ourselves a lot of license, and we hide behind some of this, making claims that we think are the greater claims that this is what we do. Some of us have lived in the church for years, been in the church for years, and our attitudes are terrible sometimes. Yes or no? I don't see anybody arguing with me on that. I think you know better than that. How much license do we give ourselves? It was devout Sabbath keepers who killed Stephen. Let's remember that. What kind of thinking do we drift into to where it seems normal and okay to think the way we do sometimes? To have the attitudes that we have sometimes, to allow our minds to start heading down a certain track to where it has a very debilitating effect on us and our loved ones and others around us. What goes on in our thoughts where God isn't in them for long periods of time, maybe days? Something we ought to question ourselves. What kind of life do we live where God is left out of our lives for an hour, 2 hours, a whole morning, a whole day, 2 or 3 days? We figure out, well, maybe we ought to bring God into it. I'm not talking about we talk about God, we read a few scriptures, and we get a little bit of prayer in. I'm talking about where we know God has spoken to us. God has revealed His will to us. He's shown us our own thoughts. He's shown us what we need to know and understand. As David prayed over and over again, simply just show me. Sometimes I go to bed not knowing if I have heard God that day. Did God correct me today? Did God speak to me about my thoughts or my attitudes? Say, well, God doesn't do that. Well, tell me what He does then. I think that's the business God is in. Sometimes I have to wonder, did I learn something about myself today? Did I learn something about God today? How many times did I make decisions or judgments inconsistent with my professed values? How many times do I repeat the same mistakes? How many times do I find my thoughts wandering down the same well-beaten path of doubt, of sin, of anger, lust, and covetousness? How many times do I revisit the same old attitudes day in and day out, week in and week out that I've had for years? How many times I just keep going back to the same thing? Or do I even recognize what is going on sometimes before it's too late? In a rare moment of honesty, maybe we ought to face the fact that we are living under the tyranny of an unexamined life. He didn't mean it to be so. He wanted us to examine it, to take a look at it, not to simply let it go, wondering, well, what did we do today? What happened to us today? Where is God? Where is God in my thoughts? But David said, God is not in the thoughts of the wicked. Could that be so about us? Paul was very concerned about the Corinthians. They had knowledge, but they were proud about it. They concluded that they could eat meat offered to idols without regard to another person's conscience. Nor did they have a concern what God Himself may have thought about that particular subject. They could freely criticize Paul and dredge up his shortcomings, and they did so, it appeared, on a regular basis. They could discriminate against another brother in the faith, in the way they conducted themselves toward their own people, in their own meetings. We read about that. And if they knew they were right, they had no conscience about causing division whatsoever. It wasn't a problem to them. And yet they claimed to be the true followers of Christ. So Paul said to them in 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 5, 2 Corinthians 13, verse 5. He said, examine yourselves as to whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you, unless indeed you are disqualified? If Christ isn't in you, you're not real. I don't care how much knowledge you have. I don't know how much explanations you have. I don't care how much other gifts you may have had in the past. If He is not there, you're not real. He's got to be there. He's got to be there all the way through. And there's no place in the person that Christ has left out. He's got to be there all the way through. We're told in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 5. Now this is a pretty tall order. And 2 Corinthians 10, and he's telling the same people, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. I haven't always done that. Matter of fact, I look back on my life. I've been in for 40 years. And I've done that all too few times. Bringing every thought into the captivity to the obedience of Christ. Doesn't say 5% of them or 2%. It says every thought. Every thought. every emotion that gets pretty wild and out of control. Bring it into the captivity of Jesus Christ. Well, I can't do that. That's right, you can't do that. That's why he says, well, you bring it into the captivity of Jesus Christ. Because he is the one who can do this. He is the one who can remove and take from you, if you're really interested in doing that. If you're really interested in saying, here's what I think. Here's what I know I am. I started a little habit here some time ago because I decided if I'm really going to change, you might say, you change? Yeah, that's right. If I am really going to change, then I've got to do something I've got to do. So I began journaling. I mean, I think you know what that is. You just say, okay, here's what I'm thinking. The good, the bad, the ugly. You put it down. This is what I'm thinking. You go back and you take a look at it. You go back and say, wow, here's what I did. Someone this morning up in Glasshouse said, you know, one time we wrote down everything we spent, this man and his wife. And I did this. And I did this for several months. He says, I couldn't believe how much money I spent on junk. You might be surprised what you think if you go back and you analyze, well, what did I do? What did I think today? What did I think yesterday? What went on? I'm serious about this. And so, you see this big, thick book? I started doing that. I'm not going to let you see what's in it. But it's pretty embarrassing. It's embarrassing to me, and if I were to read it to you, you would be embarrassed. But that's what you got to do. What's there? What's going on in your head? Where is God? Does he live in you? That's what he says. Is he there or isn't he? I got to come to some conclusions on this. You see, Jesus Christ, the last thing he needs is another inauthentic minister. And if I can't bring about these changes in my life and get down to it and take care and start taking care of thoughts, taking care of sins, then I'm not going to be in this game. I'll quit. I mean that. And I'm very, very, very serious about it. We're either in this thing, we're in it all the way, completely, or we're not in it. And I think we've read enough scriptures to where we say, this is what Christ wants, this is what Christ expects. This is a little bit of a tool, then, that I believe a person could use. I only mention this because you might want to look into it. I don't expect you to rush out and start doing this. It's something you got to be convinced about. It's something you got to determine that this is what you want to do. Do I like to do it? No. Sorry, I don't. I look at it, and I look at a blank page, and I hate it. But then I got to get down and say, okay, what did I think? What went on in my head? What happened during the day? And what went on in my head? And if I think about it, I know. I really know. But too often, we just go right past it, and we don't deal with it. If you really want to change, if you really, truly want to change, you got to do something like this. And you got to know what goes on. Now, here's what David said in Psalm 139. Now, this is very interesting. 139, verse 23 and 24. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxieties. That's very interesting the way they translate that. That means everything that I am worried about, I am anxious about. As Christ said, take no anxious thought. Okay, what is it I'm anxious about? Demonstrating or saying that there are a lot of ways in my life that I really don't trust God. There are a lot of occasions, a lot of times, a lot of spaces that are going on, big gaps in my life where God isn't there. I'm going a long ways to work things out for myself, to try to figure out how I should do it, what benefits me. We'll be talking about some of those things. David says, I got to know this and see if there's any wicked way in me and lead me in the way everlasting. Now, he's not saying, God, I want I want you to know. God already knows. What he's really saying is, would you help me to know what you already know? That's what he's really saying here. Analyze it. That's what he's saying. Now, of all the people in the Bible, and let me say, anybody who is very effective does this, but David especially did a lot of journaling. What do you think he did? Read it from Psalm 1 to Psalm 150. You have all of his thoughts and the circumstances and the situations he was in back when he was being tested by Saul, when he sinned with Bathsheba, when various other things took place, things he wondered about, things he was arguing with God about. It's all there, the good, the bad, and the ugly. It's there. You got it for it. I mean, here's a person who has revealed his innermost thoughts and feelings for us. And after he died, somebody said, let's publish this. So here's a person then who would write down his deepest, his innermost thoughts and feelings. Absolutely, you can read this. Here's a man who's an open book. And he doesn't pull any punches about what he thought sometimes. But then he also shows how he came back around. David was the man who perhaps was one of the most well-adjusted people there ever was. He was able to face himself. He was able to face what his problems were. He faced up to them. He was about the most honest person you'll ever run across. Open. And he was in touch with himself, if I can put it that way. And let me just tell you that before you can really know God, you're going to have to know yourself. I want you to think about that one for a moment. And a lot of us don't, because we operate on a very surface level with other people and with God. And we don't get down to the depths of what is really going on in our hearts and mind. Now, God will know. He's got ways of knowing, and it's something that he really wants to know. He's asking the question, as he did with his disciples, and so too is he asking now. Are you real? Are you what you say you are? Can I count on you? Is this the way it's going to be? Do I just accept it on face value? And I think you know the answer on that. 1 Corinthians 9:27, in conclusion, we're asking the question, is it possible? Is it possible to go all the way outwardly to where nobody else knows and still be inauthentic? 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 27. But I discipline my body and bring it into subjection. I'm not going to give myself a lot of license, or any license for that matter, is what he's saying. Lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. Is it possible to be a preacher of the word? To preach it sincerely, powerfully, and people are converted, and then wind up losing out? Paul says so. He says that about himself. Because he has to keep looking. He has to keep examining. He has to keep his body, as it were, under subjection. Well, thank you very much today. And as I said, I will be with you next week. Pray for our council meetings. We'd ask you to do that. We'll see you again.